Chapter 7. Sophie Elkin dragged a brush through her straight black hair, then took a hurried look at herself in the mirror. Dressed in worn khaki pants and a matching cotton shirt, and without any makeup, she would have been hard-pressed to make herself appear any plainer. Yet there was no hiding her natural beauty. She had a narrow face with high cheekbones, a petite nose, and soft aquamarine-colored eyes. Her skin was smooth and flawless, despite the many hours she spent outdoors. The features were mostly inherited from her mother, a French woman who had fallen in love with an Israeli geology student studying in Paris and had migrated with him to Tel Aviv. Sophie had always minimized her looks and femininity. Even at an early age, she spurned the dresses her mother would buy, preferring pants so she could join the neighborhood boys in rough-and-tumble activities. An only child, she'd been close to her father, who had ascended to the head of the geology department at Tel Aviv University. The independent young girl had relished accompanying him on field expeditions to study the geological formations in the surrounding deserts, where she raptly absorbed his fireside tales of biblical events on the very grounds where they camped. Her father's work led her to study archaeology in college. While attaining her advanced degrees, she was jolted by the arrest of a fellow student for stealing artifacts from the university archives. The incident introduced her to the dark world of underground antiquities trading, which she grew to detest for its impact in the destruction of historic cultural sites. Upon receiving her doctorate, she abandoned academics and joined the Israeli Antiquities Authority. With passion and dedication, she worked up to head of the Antiquities Robbery Prevention Unit in a few short years. Her devotion left little time for a personal life, and she dated infrequently, preferring to spend most nights working late. Grabbing a handbag, she left her small hillside apartment overlooking the Mount of Olives and drove toward the old city of Jerusalem. The Antiquities Authority was housed in the Rockefeller Museum, a sprawling white limestone structure situated near the northeast corner of the old city. Employing just 12 people, her department was tasked with the impossible duty of protecting the roughly 30,000 ancient cultural resource sites located around Israel. "Good morning, Soph," greeted the department's senior detective, a lanky, bug-eyed man named Sam Levine. "Can I get you a coffee?" "Thanks, Sam." "I'd like that," she said, covering a yawn as she squeezed into her cramped office. "There was some sort of all-night construction going on near my apartment last night. I slept terribly." Sam returned with the coffee and plopped down on the other side of her desk. "If you weren't going to sleep, then you should have joined us on recon last night," he said with a grin. "Any apprehensions?" "No. Our Hebron grave robbers must have taken the night off. We gave up by midnight, but did come away with a nice stack of picks and shovels." Perhaps the world's second oldest profession, grave robbing ranked near the top of the Robbery Prevention Unit's criminal hit list. Several times a week, Sophie or Sam would lead a late-night stakeout of ancient grave sites around the country where signs of recent excavation had been observed. Pots, jewelry, and even the bones themselves could usually find a ready buyer in the underground antiquities market that pervaded Israel. "Now that they know we are onto them, they'll probably lay low for a couple of weeks," Sophie said. "Or move elsewhere. Assuming they've got enough cash to buy some new shovels," he added, smiling again. Sophie glanced through some reports and news clippings on her desk, then passed one of the articles to Sam. "I'm concerned about this excavation at Caesarea," she said. Sam quickly skimmed the article. "Yes, I've heard about this. It's a university-sponsored excavation of the old port facilities. It says here that they have uncovered some 4th-century seaport artifacts and a possible grave. You really think the site is a theft target?" Sophie drained her coffee, then set down the cup with an agitated stare. "The reporter might as well have put up a banner and flashing lights. Any time the word grave finds its way into print, it's like a magnet. I've begged the news reporters 1,000 times to avoid publicizing grave sites, but they are more interested in selling papers than protecting our heritage. Why don't we go down and take a look? We are scheduled for a recon tonight, but I could reassign the boys down there. They'd probably enjoy a trip to the coast. Sophie looked at her desk calendar, then nodded. I'm free after one. I suppose we could go check it out and stay the night if it looks worthwhile. Now you're talking. For that, I'll go steal you another cup of coffee, he said, jumping out of his chair. Okay, Sam, you got a deal. Then she looked at him sternly. But just don't use the word steal around me. Situated on the Mediterranean coast, about 30 miles north of Tel Aviv, Caesarea was a lightly populated enclave easily overshadowed by its historic past as a seat of Roman power. Built by King Herod the Great as a fortified port city in the 1st century BC, Caesarea featured the famous hallmarks of Roman architecture: a high-columned temple, a grand hippodrome, and an ornate palace along the sea all graced the city, which was fed cool inland water via massive brick aqueducts. Herod's most impressive engineering feat was not on land, however. He designed and built massive breakwaters out of concrete blocks, using them to create the largest protected harbor in the eastern Mediterranean. The success of the harbor propelled Caesarea to greater importance as the capital of Judea under Roman rule, and the city remained a key commerce center for over 300 years. Sophie was well acquainted with the remains of the ancient city, having spent a summer at the site while in college. Turning off the busy coastal highway, she eased the car through a luxury home development, then entered the remains of the Roman site, which was now a protected state park. The centuries had not been kind to the original construction, its old Roman buildings having long since crumbled. Yet many remnants of the city's ancient features were still intact, including a large section of an arched aqueduct that stretched across the ochre sands, not far from a sizable amphitheater that faced the sea. Sophie parked the car in a lot near the hilltop entrance, adjacent to some Crusader-era fortifications. The university team is excavating near the harbor, she said to Sam. It's just a short walk from here. I wonder if there's anything to eat around here. He eyed the barren park hills around them with trepidation. Sophie tossed him a water bottle from the back seat. I'm sure there are some restaurants back near the highway, but you'll have to settle for a liquid diet for now. They walked down a trail that weaved toward the beach, broadening at several points along the bluff. They passed a long-forgotten road that had once been lined with residences and small businesses, their ghostly remnants little more than disorderly piles of stone. As they descended the trail, the small harbor opened up before them. There was little left to recognize its boundaries, as the original breakwaters had become submerged centuries ago. The trail led to a wide clearing, where little piles of stone were scattered across the field in all directions. A cluster of beige tents was assembled farther down, and Sophie could discern a few people working under a large awning in the center. The trail continued another 100 yards down the hill, to where the waters of the Mediterranean lapped at the beach. Two men were visible working on a small spit of land, bracketed by a pair of generators that hummed loudly in the distance. Sophie headed toward the large awning, which she could see was erected over an area of active excavation. Two young women stood near a mound of dirt, filtering the soil through a screened box. As she stepped closer, Sophie could see an older man hunched over in a trench, picking at the soil with a small trowel and brush. With rumpled clothes, a close-cropped gray beard, and a pair of glasses perched at the end of his nose, Keith Hassis bore the marked appearance of a distinguished university professor. "How much Roman treasure have you unearthed today, Dr. Hassis?" The bearded man stood up in the trench with an annoyed look on his face, which immediately transformed into a wide grin when he recognized the inquisitor. "Sophie," he thundered, "how good to see you." He hopped out of the trench and rushed over, giving her a big bear hug. "It's been too long," he said. "I just saw you 2 months ago at the Biblical Archaeology Conference in Jerusalem," she chided. "Like I said, much too long," he laughed. In her younger days, Sophie had attended numerous seminars held by the archaeology professor from the University of Haifa, which had led to a professional friendship. Hasis was a highly valued contact, as both an archaeology expert and as a source of information on newly discovered sites and destructive activity. "Dr. Hasis, this is my assistant, Sam Levine," she said, introducing her companion. Hasis introduced his nearby students, then led Sophie and Sam to a circle of camp chairs that surrounded a large cooler. The professor passed out chilled cans of soda, then wiped his brow and plopped into a chair. "Somebody needs to turn up the ocean breeze today," he said with a tired smile. Then, gazing at Sophie, he asked, "I presume this is an official visit?" Taking a drink, Sophie nodded in reply. "Any particular concerns?" "A bit of overstated publicity in yesterday's Yediot Ahuanot," she said, retrieving the newspaper article from a shoulder bag. Passing the article to Hasis, she coldly eyed Sam drain his can of soda and snatch a second from the cooler. "Yes, a local reporter stopped by for an interview a few days ago," Hasis said. "His story must have been picked up in Jerusalem." He smiled at Sophie as he passed the article back. "Nothing wrong with a little publicity for some proper archaeology," he said. "Nothing, that is, except a brazen invitation to every thief with a shovel," she replied. Hasis waved his arm through the air. "This site has been plundered for centuries. Any Roman treasure that was buried around here is long gone, I'm afraid. Or didn't your agent think so?" "What agent?" Sophie asked. "I was up in Haifa for a meeting, but my students said an antiquities agent stopped by yesterday and surveyed the project site." "Stephanie," he said, calling over his shoulder. One of the girls at the screened box hurried over. A gangly co-ed of barely 20, she stood before Hasis with a look of devotion. "Stephanie, tell us about this fellow from the Antiquities Authority who came by yesterday," he asked. "He said he was with the Robbery Prevention Unit. He wanted to check the security of our artifacts, so I gave him a tour of the site. He seemed most interested in the harbor excavation and the papyrus document." Sophie and Sam looked at each other with raised eyebrows. "Do you recall his name?" she asked. "Joseph something. He was kind of short, dark-skinned, with curly hair. Looked Palestinian, to be honest." "Did he show you any identification?" Sam asked. "No, I don't think so. Is anything the matter?" "No, not at all," Hasis said. "Thanks, Stephanie. Why don't you take some drinks down to the others?" Hasis waited until the girl left with an armful of cans, then turned to Sophie. "Not one of your agents?" he asked. Sophie shook her head. "Certainly not from the Robbery Prevention Unit." "Maybe he was from the National Parks Authority, or one of your own regional offices. These darn kids don't seem to remember anything these days." "It's possible," she replied in a doubtful tone. "Can you show us your excavation sites? I'm most interested in the tomb. As you know, the grave robbers around Jerusalem have created a cottage industry as of late." Hasis smiled, then jerked his thumb over his shoulder. "It's right behind us." The trio stood and walked around to a wide trench that ran behind the chairs. A sprinkling of red plastic markers was pinned into the ground surrounding a small section of exposed bones. Sophie recognized a femur among the remains embedded in the dirt. "There's no formal tomb. We've just uncovered a single grave at the edge of the site. It's really unrelated to the diggings here," Hasis explained. "What is this site?" Sam asked. "We believe it was something of a shipping warehouse. We targeted the area after a set of bronze scales was uncovered here some years ago. Our hope is to collect samples of grains, rice, and other food staples that might have come through the port. If successful, it will provide us a better understanding of the type and volume of trade that passed through Caesarea when it was a thriving center of trade." "How does the grave fit in?" Sophie asked. "We haven't performed any dating, but my guess is this fellow was a casualty of the Muslim invasion of the city in 638 AD. The grave lies just outside the foundation of the building, so I think we'll find that he was a lone body hastily buried against the wall. The newspaper article called it a tomb rich with artifacts, Sam noted. Chassis laughed. Journalistic license, I'm afraid. We found a few buttons made of animal bone and the heel from a sandal before we halted excavation. But that's the extent of any rich artifacts from the gravesite. Our friendly neighborhood grave robbers are liable to be sorely disappointed, Sam said. Indeed, the professor replied, for our real riches have been uncovered along the seawall. He nodded toward the Mediterranean, where the hum from the generators still drifted up the hill. We discovered an early papyrus document that has us very excited. Come, let's take a walk down to the water, then I'll show you the artifact. Chassis led Sophie and Sam to the trail, then guided them down the hill. Small ridges of scattered stone broke the soil in odd patterns around them, faint reminders of the city's once congested multitude of buildings that had long ago been reduced to rubble. Using molds to pour and set his concrete blocks in place, King Herod constructed two large breakwaters that circled toward each other like a pair of arms, Chassis lectured as they walked. Warehouses were built atop the breakwaters, and a towering lighthouse stood at the harbor entrance. I recall that an early research project mapped a large number of stones underwater believed to have fallen from the lighthouse, Sophie said. A shame Herod's work didn't survive the sea's ravages, Sam said, looking out at the water and finding little visible evidence of the original breakwaters. Yes, most all of the blocks are now completely submerged. But this is where the heart of my interest lies, Chassis said, motioning toward the invisible bay. The warehouse up the hill makes a nice field school for the students, but the port facility is what makes Caesarea unique. They crossed the beach and hiked onto a small finger of land that poked into the wave-driven sea. Two male students were laboriously excavating a deep pit in the center of the rocky spit. Nearby, a diver could be seen working in the water, applying a compressor-driven water jet under the surface. This is where the main breakwater originated, Chassis explained, speaking loudly to overcome the drone of a nearby compressor. On this site, we believe, was situated the equivalent of a customs house. One of the boys recovered the papyrus document in a shattered pot over there, he said, pointing to a nearby trench. We expanded some test trenches in several directions, but have found no other artifacts. Amazing that it would survive so close to the water, Sam said. We've found fragments of the foundation that are still above mean high tide levels. They peered into the active test pit, where one of the students pointed out a small flat section of marble tiling. Looks like you've reached the basement, Sophie remarked. Yes, I'm afraid there may not be much left to excavate. What's the diver up to? He is a marine engineer helping reconstruct the layout of the original port facilities. He seems to think there may be a subterranean chamber to our customs house and is poking around for an underwater access. Sophie walked over to the edge of the embankment and stared down at the diver. He was working in 10 feet of water almost directly beneath her, manhandling a water jet against the hard-packed bottom. Without noticing the audience above him, the diver broke off his probing and began to ascend. He held the nozzle of the water jet upright, which sprayed a fountain of water skyward when he broke the surface. Standing right in its path, Sophie was doused with a blasting spray of salt water before she could jump out of the way. "You damn fool," she cursed, wiping the salt water out of her eyes with her dripping sleeves. Realizing what he had done, the diver quickly spun the nozzle seaward, then swam to the edge of the embankment and shut off the compressor. Turning to his victim, he gazed at the wet clothes clinging tightly to her body, then spat out his regulator. "Behold, a goddess from the sea," he said with a wide smile. Sophie shook her head and turned her back on him, growing angrier at the sight of Sam laughing out loud. Chassis suppressed his own mirth and came to her rescue. "Sophie, there's a towel in my tent. Come, let's get you dried off." The diver popped his regulator back into his mouth and disappeared under the surface as Sophie followed Chassis up the trail. They reached the professor's tent, where she rubbed her hair and clothes dry as best she could. The warm breeze would dry her clothes quickly, but she shivered at the sudden evaporative cooling effect on her damp skin. "May I see the artifacts you have excavated?" she asked. "Certainly. They're right next door." The professor led her to a large peaked tent that was open at one end. Inside were the artifacts recovered from the warehouse site, mostly potsherds and tile fragments, strewn about a long linen-covered table. The student Stephanie was busy with a camera and notebook, carefully numbering and recording each piece before storing them in thin plastic boxes. Hassis ignored the artifacts and led Sophie to a small table at the back of the tent. A single sealed box was on the table, which Hassis handled cautiously as he removed the lid. "I wish we had found more," he said wistfully, standing aside to let Sophie peer into the box. Inside was an elongated patch of brown material pressed between two plates of glass. Sophie immediately recognized it as papyrus, a common writing surface in the Middle East up to the end of the first millennium. The sample was worn and frayed, yet clean rows of handwritten symbols were plainly visible down most of the document's length. "It appears to be a port facility record of some sort. I can make out references to a large quantity of grain and a herd of livestock being offloaded at the wharf," Hassis said. "We'll learn more after laboratory analysis, but I think it might be a customs bill for a merchant vessel delivering goods from Alexandria." "It's a splendid find," Sophie complimented. "With luck, it will enhance the information gathered from the warehouse site." Hassis laughed. "My luck, it will prove entirely contradictory." They both turned as a tall figure entered the tent carrying a large plastic bin. Sophie saw it was the diver, still clad in a wetsuit, his loose dark hair streaked with water. Still angered over her dousing, she began to make a caustic remark, but felt her voice wither when she was met by a bright smile and a pair of deep green eyes that bored right through her. "Dirk, there you are," Hassis said. "May I introduce the lovely but damp Sophie Elkin of the Israel Antiquities Authority? Sophie, this is Dirk Pitt Jr., on loan from the U.S. National Underwater and Marine Agency." The son and namesake of the agency head, Dirk walked over and set down the bin. Still flashing a disarming smile, he warmly shook hands with Sophie. She didn't offer a protest when he was slow to release his grip. "My apologies for the shower. I didn't realize you were standing there." "No trouble. I'm nearly dry now." She was inwardly startled at how her anger had suddenly been displaced by an odd tingle. She absently patted her hair to prove her point. "I hope you'll allow me the honor of buying you dinner tonight to make amends." Dirk's forward proposal caught her off guard, and she stumbled to answer, muttering something unintelligible. Somewhere a voice inside screamed at her for losing her normally unflappable manner. Hassis thankfully intervened to save the awkward moment. "Dirk, what's in the box?" he asked, eyeing it curiously. "Just a few goodies from the subterranean chamber." Hassis's mouth dropped. "It truly exists?" Dirk nodded. "What chamber?" Sophie asked. "While I was surveying the remains of the inshore breakwater, I found a small underwater opening near Keith's test pits. I could only squeeze my arm in, but I could feel my hand break the water's surface. That's why I was using the water jet, to blast a larger hole through the mud and concretions." "How large is the cavity?" Hassis asked excitedly. "It's not much bigger than a crawl space, about 6 feet deep, but most of it is above water. I'll go out on a limb and speculate that it was part of a cellar used for storage or records archives." "How did you come to that conclusion?" Sophie inquired. Dirk dried off the plastic bin he had carried in and carefully pulled off the watertight lid. Inside were several ceramic boxes, rectangular in shape and colored a reddish-orange. He pulled one out and handed it to Sophie. "Hopefully you can decipher its contents," he said. "They didn't teach me ancient texts in marine engineering school." Sophie set the box on a table and gently pried off the lid. Inside were a half dozen tightly wound rolls of material. They're papyrus rolls, she said in a shocked voice. Hassis could no longer contain himself, slipping on a pair of white gloves and squeezing in alongside Sophie. Let me take a look, he said, pulling one of the rolls out and slowly unrolling it across the tabletop. An odd but orderly script filled the page, handwritten with a bold stroke. It appears to be Coptic Greek, Sophie said, looking over the professor's shoulder. An ancient text developed in Egypt using the Greek alphabet, Coptic script was a common written language in the eastern Mediterranean during the time of Roman rule. Indeed, he confirmed. It appears to be an annual record from the harbor master for port fees and dockage. These are the names of vessels, with their lading, he said, running a gloved finger down a pair of columns. Isn't that a reference to the emperor? Sophie asked, pointing to a block at the top. Yes, Hassis replied, trying to interpret the heading. It's titled A Report of Caesarea Port Fees, or something to that effect, written on behalf of Emperor Marcus Maxentius. If my memory serves, Maxentius was a contemporary of Constantine. Maxentius ruled in the west and Constantine in the east before the latter consolidated power. So this must date to the early 4th century. Hassis nodded with a glimmer in his eye, then looked at the other scrolls. These may offer us an amazing glimpse into life in Judea under Roman rule. Ought to provide fodder for a good thesis or two from your students, Dirk said, as he emptied the bin of three additional ceramic boxes. Tucking the empty bin under his arm, he turned and headed out of the tent. Dirk! You just uncovered a magnificent historical find, Hassis said with wonder. Where on earth are you going? I'm gonna go get wet like a damn fool, he replied with a twisted grin, because there's plenty more where those came from.